The guest today is Ethiopia Haptamariam. Ethiopia, great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, if you go on Spotify and you look at the Spotify Top 50, it's almost completely urban and it's almost completely hip-hop. Why do you think that is?
Because kids love hip-hop music. Kids around the world love hip-hop music. It's not just in the U.S., it's around the world.
Do you have a feeling why that is? I mean, Steve Stout says it's a universal language and it's the only music people can make without instruments, and therefore it spreads throughout the world.
I think that's a part of it. I also think that hip-hop is a part of a culture and a lifestyle. Music and fashion really cross, you know, the cross-section is there. And I think around the world, you can see kids dress the same. They listen to the same kinds of music. And I think hip-hop has infused every area. And I think it's a form of expression that just, you know, kids relate to.
And where do you think it might be going?
I just had this conversation on Sunday. I think that people want music with more substance. I think that kids are really emotional. And I was talking to my goddaughter about this, who's 16, who I don't think is really expressive. And she lives in Atlanta, and I talk to her all the time. And when I'm talking to her from LA, she doesn't really open up to me that much. But when I go on her social media, I can tell what's going on with her by the lyrics that she's posting, right? So kids rely on music to really connect to what they're going through or what they're feeling. And I think that they want more substantial music that can represent what they're going through and what they're feeling. And I think that, you know, we're seeing all of us are going through a lot.
And do you think that portends, I mean, hip-hop has gone through varying phases. It was the sound of the inner city, then it was literally the sound of the streets. We had the riots in 1992. Then at the end of the MTV era, it was about boats and babes, et cetera. Do you think it's going to, in the era of Ferguson and Me Too, you think it's going to be grittier and more honest?
Definitely. But I think, look, hip-hop is, there are different forms of hip-hop that exist. It's just about what's the most popular at the time. I mean, I think we can look at Spotify today. We see how huge Post Malone's record is. And I think you can see that Post is influenced by a lot of different kinds of music. And his hooks are very melodic. And you can tell that he's also, you know, influenced by country music as well. And he relates to a lot of different kids. But I do think what's going to come up more is more substantial lyrics. You look at J. Cole's record, which cut through in such a big way. And I wasn't really surprised by it, because I think a lot of us were having the conversation around it not just being one kind of hip-hop that represented where the culture was. And I think J. Cole did the perfect record that really represented what the commercial sound was from a production standpoint, but also lyrically touched on every aspect of where the culture is now. Like, there's a little bit too much of one representation of the culture, where it can kind of feel like it's a little comedic in some ways. And then other ways, you're like, kids are doing drugs and they're only talking about certain aspects of, you know, money or et cetera, because they're really just trying to hide what they really feel. They don't know how to express the emotions that they're dealing with. And I think that he really touched on that with this record without feeling too preachy.
But the previous record was kind of a disappointment, right?
With J. Cole's record?
Yeah, financially.
I don't think so. It was pretty successful.
Okay,
yeah.
Maybe I'm not deep into it.
J. Cole's been extremely successful. I mean, you know, I'm not going to lie. I'm a big J. Cole supporter. I signed him when I was at Universal Publishing when he released his second mixtape, The Warm Up, before he, you know, put out his first album, et cetera. And he's one of the most authentic, realist artists that's been operating and marching to the beat of his own drum. And it's been incredible to see. But he's been successful with every record.
Okay, so you're from Hotlanta, as the Allman Brothers say.
Yes.
Okay, why is Atlanta an epicenter of hip-hop music, urban music?
I wouldn't even just say urban music. Okay, so I'm from Atlanta. All right, I'm first-generation Ethiopian-American. My parents are from Ethiopia, hence the name Ethiopia.
Okay, let's go back there.
Yeah.
You've been living for almost 40 years with the name Ethiopia. Why am I having a hard time?
38 years.
Okay. Okay. Well, I didn't want to go exactly. I'll let you go exactly, you know. Has that been a good thing or a bad thing?
Okay, so early years, elementary years, I was in Tuskegee, Alabama. My dad had been the dean of the vet school there since I was a kid. And during the early 80s, that's when you saw all the commercials about the famine in Ethiopia, right? So, you know, I'm there. My name's Ethiopia. Tragic. It was extremely tough for me. So anyone that knows me from Tuskegee, Alabama, actually knows me by my middle name, which is Haywin. And that was because I took it upon myself to change the name while in school. Like, oh, no, I'm not going through this. You're going to know me as Haywin. So then we moved to Atlanta the summer before my sixth grade year. And go to sixth grade, Ralph Bunch Middle School in Southwest Atlanta. Who's in my class? A group by the name of Crisscross. And they weren't discovered yet. They got discovered that year, but one of the members of the group, Chris Smith, the lighter-skinned one with the braids, was one of my really close friends. And they get discovered and become the biggest group in music at the time, and it was crazy. You know what I mean? So Crisscross happens, and it's, like, right in my backyard, which was fascinating.
Did you wear your jeans backwards?
No, I didn't. But I definitely, you know, I was, like, super proud of them, of him, of what was happening in the scene at the time. And that's when I think I got to see firsthand what was happening in the community. So it was like Jermaine Dupri, So Def. You saw ABC and Dallas Austin start his, you know, kind of run. And to me as a kid, it felt like the biggest thing in the world. I mean, I remembered when Crisscross was on tour with Michael Jackson. That was crazy. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was massive.
Well, let's go back. Your parents are from Ethiopia. How did they end up coming to America?
My father came on scholarship to the University of Colorado, then went back to Ethiopia, married my mother. They went to Canada, had my older brother, and then my father went to get his PhD at UC Berkeley. My mother went to UC Davis, and so they came for education. My father was, you know, my father didn't really come from much. He was like the one kid out of eight kids to get chosen to go to school. And my mom, on the other hand, came from a very well-off family. My grandfather was the first pilot in Ethiopia. My dad is 10 years older than my mom. And, they fell in love, and they're still married. They're still together.
And so how many children in your family?
Three.
And where are you in the hierarchy?
I'm in the middle.
Really? I'm in the middle,
too. Yeah, but I'm special because I'm the only girl. So
we'll talk about that later. So You move from Alabama, you move to Atlanta, and if you go online, there was a moment where there was a school presentation that changed the course of your history.
Right. So freshman in high school, there's a career planning class that was a prerequisite, right? And, you know, I loved music. For me, being this, you know, young kid with the name, whatever, I just felt awkward growing up, as a lot of people do. Music was how I connected to, and how I felt like I related to a lot of other people, right? So I was always the girl that was, like, writing down all the lyrics. I was a writer myself. I would journal, et cetera. I loved music. I lived and breathed music. I tried to sing. I sang in talent shows. It didn't really work for me because I'm tone deaf, you know, that whole thing. But freshman year in high school, I'm taking this class, the career planning class, and my teacher asked me what I want to do, and you had to pick three different things, and everything was music related. But I only knew about music production or what I would read about in the fanzines. I think I said publicity. And at the time, she had a woman that named Shanti Das, who was the head of promotions for LaFace Records at the time, come and speak in our class. And this woman was the coolest, most confident, strong black woman I had ever seen. And she was just, you know, fly to me. I grew up loving, like, TLC and Aaliyah and, like, the Fugees. And, you know, that was, like, my thing. And so I'm seeing this woman, and she works in promotions. I have no idea what it is. So I go up to her at the end of class, and I'm like, can I shadow you for a day? And she's like, okay, if your parents are okay with it. I asked my parents, and she let me come shadow her on the day that her assistant was out sick. So I was answering phones, et cetera, right? And I was good at it. So she said, as you know, I could come up during the summer as long as my parents were okay with it. And my parents were like, we need to meet her. And she actually was from my neighborhood, and so she came to my house and met my parents, and they gave my gave the blessing, and I interned that summer. And this was like the heyday of LaFace was a full record label. I mean, they were with Arista, but they had an A&R department, a production department, a marketing department, the video department. I mean, they were a full fledged record label in Buckhead, Atlanta. And at the time, they had Outkast, TLC, Toni Braxton. These were huge artists. That summer, I got to go to, like, the Outkast Southern Playalistic cookout. I'll never forget it because I got to invite my 8 friends, right? I was, like, the coolest person ever. And my older brother, who was a freshman in college at the time, took me and was, like, the chaperone. And we were doing everything from, like, stuffing bags, whatever. But the work we were doing was just, it was incredible to be around it. I remember seeing Biggie Smalls there, Busta Rhymes there. And this was when Puff was about to start building the, you know, Bad Boy. I remember the the Big Mac tape. It was promoting Craig Mack and Biggie Smalls at the same time. So I was around that as a kid at 14.
That's unbelievable.
It was incredible. I mean, it was really incredible. And Outkast to me was, you know, my favorite hip hop group. They were produced by a production team called Organized Noise that was also from Southwest Atlanta, who I just had such a high regard for, and I loved their, you know, their musical talent and gift. And before I could drive, I would have my father drive me on Sundays by their studio because I knew where it was. I'm like, Daddy, can we drive? You know, because to me, it was amazing to know that the music that was touching the world in my eyes was like happening right out of my neighborhood. So it gave me this sense of hope that I could be a part of that in some way.
We'll take a quick break and come back with more of my conversation with Ethiopia Habtemariam, recorded at the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California. This podcast is brought to you by TuneIn, which brings together all the live sports, music, news, and podcasts you love. Original, live, and on-demand audio, all in one place. Go to TuneIn.com/LeftSets to download and listen. Okay, let's get back to my conversation with Ethiopia Habtemariam in front of a live audience at my Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California.
Okay, you know, traditionally growing up with immigrant parents can be difficult. They're strict. They come from a different background. Did you experience any of that?
Yes. But also, so I never got a chance to go back to Ethiopia until I was older, until I was like maybe 22 or 23. And I didn't know why, because my father's the dean at this, you know, university. I'm like, we're pretty well off. You know, I'm thinking we are, but we're really not. We should be, given my dad's position. But it wasn't until I went back home that I realized my father was taking care of a lot of people, a lot of family members. We have a huge family there, but here, we did not. I didn't know many family members. When my friends would have family reunions and things, I couldn't relate to that experience at all because I only knew my 2 aunts on my father's side and my, you know, my aunts and uncles on my mom's side. But we had a huge family, and my father was taking care of everyone, not only on his side of the family, but also my mother's side of the family. They were really all one family back in Ethiopia. And so my father worked so much that he wasn't, you know, as tough on me because he was just working all the time. But also, I was a really good kid. Like, I didn't want to ever disappoint my father or my parents at all. And my mom, she was probably stricter on me, as mothers would be, right? But she got sick when I was in high school.
And is she still with us?
Yeah. She got sick when I was in high school, and she wasn't that present. So, you know, I really had a lot of freedom.
And so what are your siblings doing today?
My older brother is still in Atlanta. He works at the Fox Theater there, running production on that side. And then my little brother graduated from the University of Georgia. He actually took this year off to help my father. My father got diagnosed with Parkinson's in November, so he's had to retire. My little brother is there helping him, you know, deal with stepping down from being at the university, et cetera. My little brother is like an angel. He's brilliant, but also like this amazing amazing kid, well, man. But
okay, so your parents have a big insistence on education because your father is so educated?
Yes. So when I was, you know, when I was younger, my father would like go to Boston. We'd go visit like MIT and Harvard or whatever. My father wanted me to either be a lawyer or be a scientist, et cetera. And I thought for a second about being a lawyer, but once I got introduced to music, that was all she wrote. That was it. but I won't lie, it wasn't that easy. So when I go through high school, I graduate, and so I intern at LaFace, and I just get into the music community there. There's so much happening. And then I find out about this internship program. I got a paid internship when I was 16 at Elektra Records, the satellite office there in Atlanta. I graduate at 17. I get hired as an assistant at LaFace in the production department, which wasn't really sexy, but I was making a check, and then I could still help out in marketing and promotions or whatever. So I did that. But my father was like, no, you have to go to college. I'm like, just give me a year, Dad. Like, let me just see how this goes. It might turn into something. And he was pretty supportive of that. My mom, not so much. But she had gone to Ethiopia to go visit the family that first year. So she didn't really, like, get to hold me back. You know what I mean? So my dad was coming back and forth from Alabama, and I was just working. And I really just worked my butt off. I did everything. I would babysit to make extra money, and that led to other opportunities. I ended up working.
How did babysitting lead to other opportunities?
Okay, so I babysitted for the woman named LaRonda Sutton, who started L.A. Reid's publishing company, Hitco Music Publishing. Okay, she started it, and it was in the LaFace office. She was fabulous. She would walk past my cubicle, and she would say things to me like, you're going to work for me one day. I like how you answer phones. I was like, okay, that's good, you know. And so she was a single mother and needed help. And so I was working as an assistant. I would leave. I would babysit for her until she was able to come home. And then at night, I'd be in the clubs doing whatever. So when LaRonda left Hitco, she went to Edmunds Music Publishing in Los Angeles. And she told me I'd be a great music publisher. She knew my taste. I would play her records, et cetera. And she was the one that offered me an opportunity to work in publishing at Edmunds Music Publishing, and that's how I got the job there.
Okay, so you never do go to college.
Never do go to college.
And any regrets there?
No.
Okay, that's
no.
Definitive.
No, however, I don't think that's the route for everyone. And I do think education is important as long as you know your interests and like the things that you want to learn about. I think I'm at a point in my life where there are other things that I'm interested in that I would want to like go back to school to learn about, but no regrets.
Okay, so you're in Atlanta, you're working at LaFace, you're starting as an assistant answering phones. What's the next step up the ladder?
At the same time that I was doing that, I was helping out in marketing. I was helping out in the promotions department. And I was doing a lot. And I wanted a full-time job in marketing. I wanted to be in marketing. The general manager there at the time, though, was like, you know, you need to go to college. We're not going to hire you full-time. You need to go to college. And I was like, you know what? My father isn't even making me go to college. And I had the support of all the executives there, et cetera. And I remember, do you guys remember the Impact Music Convention? Yeah. So I remember I wrote the GM a proposal, and I sent it to him, and I said, this is why LaFace should sponsor me going to the Impact Music Convention. And so they paid for my travel and my registration to go to the convention. And he was like, when you come back, you have to make a decision if you're going to go to school, you know, or if you're just going to continue on here working part-time, but I'm not hiring you full-time. And I came back, and I was like, I quit. I didn't have a job in place, by the way. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I just felt like they didn't really value me, and I wasn't going to be forced, you know, into being a scenario where I had to just stay a part-time. I was doing a lot for the company at the time. I had met a guy named Doug Brown. Doug Brown was partners with Johnny Wright. They were managing Left Eye as a solo artist at the time. And I was like the only person that was like nice to him because LA didn't know who Johnny Wright was and know who Doug Brown was. And they were like, who the hell are these people managing Left Eye? I was a nice person to him. So I got introduced to NSYNC through that relationship. I quit. and started working with NSYNC and their charity organization, like helping them put their charity like organization together, celebrity basketball games, parties. My goal was to like infuse the cool urban scene in Atlanta to what NSYNC was doing, but this was like right at the beginning. So I would get like Jermaine Dupri and people like that to come play in their games and stuff. And I just made extra money doing that until I could figure out what I was gonna do next.
And what did you figure out you wanted to do?
That's when LaRonda offered me the job in music publishing.
And how long after you quit was that?
That was probably a year and a half.
Okay, that was in Atlanta.
That was in Atlanta. And at the time, my father was very supportive. I remember the SkyTel two-way pagers. I told my dad, I said, Daddy, if I'm going to make it, you have to buy me a SkyTel two-way pager. You have to have one in order to be in the music business. So he bought me a SkyTel two-way pager. He bought me a fax machine that I had in my bedroom. And I had, like, I always had, like, the latest computer because my father had them from work. And I would just work from my bedroom.
So your father actually was very supportive.
He was, yeah.
Okay, so you work in publishing. What do you learn immediately working in publishing?
Right, because I didn't know what publishing was when I took the job. So I was a song plugger, basically. Edmunds Music Publishing was Babyface and Tracy Edmunds Publishing Company. It was administered through EMI. And they had about 10 writers signed to them at the time. And when I got there, the job was to really build morale amongst the writers and to help shop their songs. But it was a tough situation because I think a lot of the writers were under the impression that they would be writing with Babyface. And that was not the case. he didn't deal with them at all. So it was a little tough. And I tried my best. I put together writing camps. This is like you know, 2000, 2001, putting together a lot of writing camps, et cetera, with them. And I would go to New York and shop records, you know, and I knew I wanted to be in New York because that's where it was all happening in the industry. At the time, I will say this happened. So I because of my relationship with NSYNC, they were working on their last album at the time. And I was able to get a track placed on their last album with some producers that were actually signed to Universal Publishing. And one of them had worked with one of my writers at Edmunds. And it was a huge deal because these producers hadn't really been that active on the Universal side. And I got this placement for NSYNC. It was a really big deal. And I remember Tom Sturgis, who was at Universal Publishing at the time, wanted to know how that happened because he couldn't believe these producers got a cut on NSYNC. And I got the call from Universal because he wanted to meet with me. And they offered me a job.
That was when David Renzer was running
it? Yeah, that's when David
Renzer. That's how I first became aware of you through
Renzer.
Yeah,
that's when I first got a job. I had only been at Edmunds, though, for maybe 8 months. And I was like, I'm still learning what publishing is. I can't leave. I'm not ready for this, but thank you. You know, and I was loyal to the opportunity that I had at Edmunds, so I stayed there for 2 years. Then an opportunity came about in New York at Universal Publishing. I got hired there as a creative manager like a year and a half later.
So what's it like being a single woman now moving to New York?
I was making no money. I think I was probably making $45,000 a year. It was hard. It was extremely hard. I remember times walking out of that building at 1755, like it's raining, the wind is blowing, and like literally just crying because it was tough and I was broke. I had to take the ferry across Jersey, you know. It was tough. It was really, really tough. But I made it work. And the first person I signed was Joe Budden. He had this track called Pump It Up that was exploding at the time. I also found that, like, there weren't a lot of fans of the publishing company at the time when I got there. Like, Kedar Massenburg was there. He was a bit of an asshole. I remember him seeing... I mean, these are people I would read about, too, so I was, like, excited when I would see him in the hallway, and Kedar was like, oh, yeah, you work for the publishing company? Yeah, fuck them. And I'm like, what? You know what I mean? Like, that was my introduction to some of the people because they just didn't support what we were doing at the publishing company. So it was... I learned a lot during those first couple of years. And I went back to Atlanta a lot, too, though, because the music scene was always happening there. Because of my relationships that I had when I was coming up and I was young, when I got the job in publishing, Ludacris had been a DJ on the radio, an on-air personality. When I got the job, he's huge now. He left EMI Publishing and came and signed with me at Universal, which was a big deal at the time. And from that... David supported me in signing new things that I wanted to develop. So that was his producer, Polo De Don, who went on to have like huge hits with Pussycat Dolls, Fergie, et cetera. I signed a writer named Carrie Hilson, who wrote records with like Timbaland, like The Way I Are. She wrote records for Usher, Ciara, et cetera. But these were, I signed them before they all had these hits.
So how did you find them?
They were in Atlanta. I knew Polo from my younger years in Atlanta, being on the scene. He was an artist, an aspiring hip-hop artist, and had started producing music. And when I heard his beats, I was like, okay, these are great. So when I signed Ludacris, I immediately signed him after that because I had the trust of David. He was like, you brought in this huge deal. You know, I had the leeway to sign new and developing things too. And it ended up, actually, Polo had a hit on Ludacris, and then Carrie started having hits, et cetera. And I just started building my roster from there.
And how did you end up in L.A.?
The Motown gig.
So you're in New York till the Motown gig?
Yes.
Okay. So you're working in publishing. Do you foresee that your career is going to be in publishing?
I did, actually. I dibbled and dabbled in A&R. So I signed an artist named Ciara to a publishing deal. She had a lot of success with her first record, and she was supposed to make her second album, and she didn't have a great relationship with the label. Because her A&R guy that was there wasn't there anymore. And so because I'm her publisher, she wants me to A&R the record. I'd never done A&R before. I was like, all right, we're going to give this a go. And that's how I learned A&R, like working with her and doing the second album. I knew Barry Weiss through that dynamic. And we had a lot of success with the second album. And because I remember we came out the same day Gwen Stefani was putting out her solo record, and we beat her. Like, we came in number one. We had a lot, you know, and that's how I got my introductions to A&R.
And were you making more than $45,000 now?
I'd been promoted because I had some success. I think I was probably a senior director or something like that at the time. So I did A&R, and I liked it. It was a lot. I had a lot of respect for A&R. Like, as a publisher, you really feel like you're at the ground level because you're working with creators and songwriters, and you really know what's next before, I thought, always before labels did, you know? And in some cases, you do because you have a lot more time to develop and nurture things, whereas at a label, it can be really difficult. You just have to know how to manage your roster and manage your time in order to do both, right? But as a publisher, you definitely have more time to nurture and develop talent overall. And when I got into A&R, I loved the process of helping to make a body of work and helping an artist see their full vision come to life.
So how many years were you in New York at Universal Publishing?
I just segued from being in a dual role between Universal Publishing and the label, because I was made an EVP of Urban and co-head of the creative department probably 5 years ago, 6 years ago. I can't keep track of the time. That probably about 6 years ago. And I segued out of the publishing company like a year ago.
So what is the dream for you personally?
Shit. The dream for me personally, to find balance, right? To like, I love what I do in music. And, you know, growing as a music executive, as you move up the corporate ladder, you see yourself kind of getting sometimes away from the creative process that you loved and enjoyed. And for me, it's about having a better balance between both, because that creative process is actually what fuels me. You know what I mean? Like, I love making the records, connecting with the talent, et cetera. And so just having more of a balance of that. This is all a part of my life.
Okay, but is there time for romance?
Yeah.
There is. Okay, you can make time for that.
Always time for romance. I was engaged. So I was engaged 5 years ago, and I called it off.
Why'd you call it off?
He wasn't the right one.
And was that he in the music business?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's leave it there.
So at least he understood your lifestyle.
Yeah.
Okay. So as now as we keep creeping and your biological imperative is, the clock is ticking louder. Does that bother you? If you didn't have children, would that be okay?
What type of shit is that?
No, the point is, you're a very powerful, strong executive.
Right.
You're a role model for people.
Yeah.
The question is, can you do it all?
I do think you can do it all. For me, I've never looked at it like I couldn't. You know what I mean? I'll be honest with you. I never looked at it like I couldn't. I was a hopeless romantic. I never believed that I couldn't have it all. I don't really subscribe to those thoughts or ideas. Yes, I can have it all. It just has to be with the right person.
Okay, so.
By the way, you sound like my I'm like, wait, you sound like my dad.
We'll take a quick break and come back with more of my conversation with Ethiopia Habtemariam, recorded at the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California. This week, I'm speaking with the president of Motown Records. 2 weeks ago, I had Moby from the LA Times Festival of Books. And last week, we heard Brazilian legend Gilberto Gil, who welcomed me into his studio in the hills of Rio de Janeiro. Be the first to hear next week's episode by subscribing to the podcast on TuneIn, Apple Podcasts, or your podcast player of choice. Check out the first 20 interviews and please rate and review the podcast. Okay, let's get back to my conversation with Ethiopia Habtemariam in front of a live audience at my Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California.
Being a powerful black woman in society, and there's a lot of paid attention to you,
right.
Pointed at you. And do you feel responsibility to be a role model?
I have to live my life for me. Yes, I do. But I feel a responsibility to myself first. And I can't really get too caught up in that. But I of course, am aware that people look up to me because I know that there were people that I looked up to. But you quickly learn that you can't, idolize people, or you can't think that people won't make mistakes. And so I just want to be comfortable with the decisions that I make for my life. And I've gotten to a place where I'm like, I got to do what's right for me.
And do you feel any responsibility with your position in power to impact other parts of the culture?
Definitely.
And what does that look like?
For me, it's about how I relate to the artists and talent that I deal with. There are times when they can be going through certain things in their life, or I think the artists have the biggest platforms to really affect change. And so I know the conversations that I have in the background, or if I'm helping them through situations in their own life to get them to a place that they can create art that I know will affect people.
So you find you're actually leading the act as opposed to the act leading you?
It depends on the scenario. Or in certain situations, it may have been the writer. Like, there have been times I've been in sessions where an artist may be, I know that they're emotionally in a certain place in their lives, and they don't have a good translator. So it's my job to identify the right people to have in the room to help bring that out of them, and then to translate what I know will come out and connect to other people. And that's a gift, you know what I mean? And it's worked in a lot of ways. And then also, I have this writer named Sebastian Cole, right? 35-year-old black man from Birmingham, Alabama. I signed him when he was living out of his car in Los Angeles, drove to LA to pursue his dreams, et cetera. He went on to write the Alessia Cara hits, Here, Scarcity, You're Beautiful, et cetera, et cetera. To me, that feels like my contribution to the culture as well, because I know that someone like him would not have normally gotten an opportunity to get the kind of deal that he got and that belief early on. I mean, I signed him way before there was the smashes, et cetera. And so I feel very privileged because I'm able to provide those opportunities for people that I know have the gift, and then helping them get to a place where they can create music that'll touch people. So whether it was a Sebastian or it was, these writers from Atlanta named Rock City who went on to be huge pop songwriters, that's a gift for me because I know that normally they wouldn't get those shots.
And to what degree do you feel racism in the music industry?
Okay, so I'll be honest about it, because I have to be. Racism wasn't something that I had thought about in the industry for a long time. When you put your head down and just do the work and you're working so much, it wasn't something that I had thought about. So it wasn't until I got the Motown gig that it came up for me. Now, when I was pursuing my career in music, I read every trade magazine, and you know, there were the people I looked up to. It wasn't artists. It was other executives that I, you know. So there were a lot of women of color that were in senior roles on the A&R side across all the labels, right, and the publishing companies, et cetera. And I never looked at it like there being an issue before. When I got the job at Motown, and I was originally hired as an SVP of A&R, Motown was moved under Island Def Jam. And I remember the switch. I remember the conversations changing where people were pointing out to me the lack of black executives in the music business and have you noticed the change, et cetera. And I started noticing that there was a change. You know, there was a lot of conversation around the role at Def Jam. And I hadn't really thought about it in that way before because I wasn't a person who thought about, like, because I was a woman or because I was black, I wouldn't ever make it. And this is from me as a kid. I never thought about those things. And it may have been because I was in Atlanta where I was surrounded around a lot of success, a lot of huge success, but around people that looked like me. So I never thought it would be an issue. I moved to New York, still didn't think it was an issue. And then I noticed that there was a change. Also, urban music got to a place where we weren't making as much money, right? So I choose to take the Motown, to be in this dual role. I became a very successful music publisher. And then having success doing A&R as well, I also managed Carrie Hilson. She went from being a songwriter to an artist. I helped her get her deal and then managed her in addition to being a publisher, right? So I got to grow and see a lot as a creative executive, and I became very powerful in the business. But then I took this role at Motown, and things were changing. You could have a number one urban record, and it didn't equate to anything, right? So the power base changed, and it became a real issue for the lack of black executives in the business. You just saw, like, a complete shift happening, and it wasn't really spoken about. You just felt it, and there were a group of people that would talk about it a lot, and I had to educate myself. I had mentors, and I still have a mentor in my life, Clarence Avon, that just educated me on the history of the business and things that had happened before, and looking at what was happening, you know, at the time and what's happening currently. But I do feel a real responsibility for making sure I create opportunities for people that look like me. I remember, you know, at one point renegotiating my deal at Universal Publishing, and Jay Brown, Roc Nation, someone I respect and admire, I'm having hits after hits after hits. And it's Polo having hits, Esther Dean, my songwriter, you know, Esther Dean is one of my songwriters. She's having a lot of hits. And he said to me, he have them take urban out of your title. Because I was like the head of, he's like, have them take urban out of your title. You know, all your writers are writing all the pop hits. And I was like, shit, okay. I didn't really think about that. And then I remember speaking to another friend of mine. He was like, well, if you do that, will there be a responsibility at these companies for them to hire people that look like you? I was like, you know what? Yeah, you're right. So I kept it in my title. It's not something that I run away from. I'm proud of the culture that I come from. I'm clearly Ethiopian American, but I grew up in the South, in, you know, all black neighborhood, et cetera. But my experiences and things that I went through as a kid are very similar to what a lot of other people went through. But my culture and what I lived and breathed is I'm fine to represent that. And I'm fine to give opportunities for talent that also come from that same culture as well. And I think it's important to have people inside of the companies that can relate to it on that level. Not just look at it through a computer screen or through their phones and say, oh, I'm urban because I'm watching your culture. You know what I mean? But not really having understood it or lived it or breathed it. And I think that there's a responsibility to these companies to know the difference and have people in there that actually, like, are from it.
And what about being a woman in the music industry and a woman in society, especially in light of the Me Too movement in the last 8 months or so?
I mean, you know, it's kind of similar in that.
Let's start from, have you personally, not that we need details, had bad experiences?
I have had bad experiences. Not a lot of them. I've had situations more with, you know, sometimes with like aggressive talent or aggressive. There's been this weird thing that might happen with talent where they feel like you're theirs. You know what I mean? Like, because you're a woman or you might be nurturing, et cetera, they get those lines blurred or whatever, and then you have to check them. But I've always been a person that's been about checking them. Even when, like, there was a time I was doing street promotions and I would come across situations dealing with promoters or et cetera, I had no problem checking them, you know?
Just to be clear, because I'm a male.
Yeah.
And we're on the other side of the fence. Give me an illustration of what checking somebody would be like.
I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you a story about when I was at LaFace, and in addition to being a production assistant, I was also doing promotions and would do street promotions, et cetera. And I remember going to North Carolina or South Carolina or something with some of my girlfriends that were helping me for this party that we were doing. And we had to deal with the promoter, and he had his friends. So we have a successful event. They decide to show up to our hotel room. And a few of my friends had been drinking. We had ordered room service. So I'm the person that knew to just, like, grab one of the knives and put it under the pillow just in case anything gets crazy, right? That's just how I was. And I think the guys thought it was going to be another kind of situation. I'm like the one that, like, get up, get the fuck out of here. You know what I mean? Like, how dare you even try? This was like it was one of those situations where, like, I work for LaFace Records. I'm here to, you know, as someone that's working on this event, how dare you try us? And they really felt like because my friends were there and they were, you know, being social, that it could be something more. And I think the moment you allow the lines to get a little blurred, people feel like they can really test you and take it there. And you just can't be afraid to speak up and say, I'm not going to allow that to happen. And I've had other extreme situations as I've gotten older where you've had to just deal with it in the immediate and know not to let things even get to the point where they could get blurred.
Has the opposite been true ever, where you say, well, the lines may be blurred, but this will work to my advantage career-wise, so I don't want to cross the line, but I'm willing to ride with it?
No. Like, just letting people get away with things because it's going to work for my career?
Well, it's interesting. Culturally, I think this is, you know, it's very illustrative. The way you're saying, you know, white women seem to, you know, it seems like the strong black woman, the image is like, they're shutting it down. And,
I'll tell you, it was really about respect. It was really about respect because I respect myself within my career, and I want you to respect me as an executive first. Like, I would never want them to think it could be anything else, you know? I will tell you, there was a time with a producer that I worked with where I think he felt, because I worked very closely with him, he felt like the relationship was more than what it was, and I was like, are you fucking delusional? You know what I mean? And it's really because it can become an intimate dynamic when you're, you know, if they get to call you at 3 a.m. and you're making yourself available to talk through a concept or idea, but you don't have any romantic feelings for them, it's not anything like that. It's a part of the art of being an A&R or making records, et cetera. You go through that. You know what I mean? But this fool lost his mind. Like, and the moment you're in a relationship, it's like, he couldn't handle it. He couldn't handle me being in a relationship. He felt like I, whatever. And I was like, are you out of your mind? And he was. And there that went.
I mean, are you one of a kind, or are your friends as strong as you are?
Listen, I'm not going to try and come off as like I'm a super strong person all the time. That's not my truth. That's not my truth. I do think I'm one of a kind.
That's okay, the truth. And you know, if you look at what happened in Ferguson, and now that everyone has a phone in their camera, we see all these racial elements, and then we have Kanye saying George Bush doesn't like black people, and now he's cozying up to Trump. Okay, I guess these are two questions. You might mix the answers together. But is there an inherent injustice? Because African American culture is ruling the culture. Right. So it's kind of ironic that it's not getting the respect economically and culturally in terms of equality.
Right. So what's the question again?
Question is first, do you personally feel that injustice of being a black person in America, and are you taking any steps or contemplating any steps to rectify that?
Yes.
And what might they look like in terms—
Yes, I do feel the injustices that exist. What steps am I taking?
I mean, if you look at it as a white person, mm-hmm. we're listening to Ice-T, and we're, you know, fuck the police, et cetera, you know, NWA, and all of a sudden, the 1990, the Rodney King thing happens. And, holy shit, everything in the records was true.
Right.
Okay? So there's a catch-up, and I still believe there's an education that the white people need that they're
100%,
not getting.
100%. So I have friends that are white, that are Asian, et cetera, and I find myself— You know, I have one of my closest friends is a white woman who only dates black or Latino men, right? And as this conversation and the incidents that have happened over the past, let's say it's been 5 years, et cetera, having to educate her about what that would mean, I'm like, if you have a kid, you're going to have a black son. So let's talk about what that experience will be like and what how you'll have to handle that as a mother. And I feel like it's my responsibility to really educate the people that I'm around, and to not make them feel like they can't talk to me about it. You know what I mean? If I can be the person to try and be a bridge and educate the people that I know do have good hearts but don't really understand, because I think that we're all at a place. Racism is real, but I'm an empath, and I learned that about myself pretty early on. I know about humanity, and I connect to human beings. That's who I am. That's how I connect to music. That's how I know we're really all the same. If I have the opportunity to get you to understand who I am, who my people are, and I can connect with you, because I really do have compassion for other people, no matter what your race is, no matter what you're going through. I'm like one of those people that fucking cry in a commercial if I feel like, if I see someone, I really do feel it. I want to be that bridge to educate them. And I, to be honest with you, I'm trying to find other ways to make a difference, you know, because it's not just the typical tweet something or post something and say it's this. How do you really, I think, you know, it's about kids feeling like they can communicate amongst each other and educate them without them feeling isolated. I'm trying to find the right way to go about it, honestly. But I do think in how I carry myself on an everyday basis, how I deal with my coworkers, how I operate, could be an example.
Okay, you talked about having mentors. Are you now a mentor yourself to certain individuals?
Yeah, I am. You know, there was a point at the publishing company where my whole urban department was all women. But a diverse group of women, you know, white women, there was an Asian woman, a mixed, whatever. And it wasn't by design. It wasn't because I was like, I'm going to have a department of all women. These were just really dope people. And I looked up one day and it was all women. I had other people at other publishing companies coming to me and saying, like, how did you, you know, like, you have a whole squad. I was like, one person said to me, like, you guys are the pink ladies. You should have jackets. I was like, okay, you're a fucking asshole, but you're actually right. It would actually look dope if we showed up like that, right? But because I didn't even notice that they were all women and they were really dope. And this was, you know, several years ago. And all of those women I mentor and other young women reach out to me all the time. One of the things I pride myself in is helping to develop other executives. So when I was coming up, one of the things I noticed, I don't think a lot of people talk about this, is that you come across people that don't want to help other people or people that feel intimidated because they may be getting older, et cetera, that this young person coming up is going to take my job. They operate from an insecure place. And I was like, I'm never going to be that person, ever, 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 because I experienced it myself. And so I made it a point to, you know, I've kind of been known as a person that will grow people from assistants, et cetera, into being, you know, vice presidents, et cetera. And so I'm proud that I've been able to do that and help other people get opportunities at other companies. I'm proud of that.
For those of us who lived through the 60s, music played a big part in terms of the, at the time, called the revolution. We can debate the effect of the revolution, but certainly the Vietnam War was stopped and music helped. So there was the invasion of Iraq in the beginning of the century, and everyone said, where's the protest music? And there wasn't any protest music. Now, in light of all of Trump and all this craziness, people are saying, where is the protest music? But in reality, that's a white perspective. The white people and the white acts are really not making protest music. But Run the Jewels, there are a million African-American acts. What is it going to take for one of those songs to become an anthem?
I think it has to be a great song.
So you think we haven't found the song yet?
I don't know if we have. I don't know if we've come across... I don't know if we have the music yet that's going to connect to all people. Also, you know, the people of influence that can really create the music that can, you know, connect all of us, I don't think that they've gone there yet. I think that we need music that really relates to what we're all experiencing, and we haven't seen or experienced, like, the talent that's that can be the right vessel for it. And when you have people like a Kanye doing the crazy shit that he's doing, I think it... He's confused a lot of people. He's confused a lot of artists about where to stand. And, you know, I agree with you. We are missing out on the protest music. We're missing out on the music that really speaks to what's happening in this country. And I don't know why it's not. I don't know why it's not being created. You know what I mean? I don't know why people aren't being honest in their music and not really expressing themselves in that way and really making an effort to do it. I think that there's some people that are, but not the big superstars that we need to...
If we focus on Kanye, forgetting what he's done, you know, who knows when this will air as a podcast, but what is Kanye's place in African-American culture?
He's considered to be one of the greats, one of the most influential artists of our time.
And you agree with that?
Yeah.
So when he comes out and he says things that are pro-Trump, and he does some crazy stuff, do you think it's an incredible art experience, mind fuck on the culture to get people to think? Or do you believe that he's just lost his mind?
He has the right to be pro-Trump. I also think that he has the responsibility to be well-informed. And I also think that the ego is a powerful, powerful thing. And I think that he's aware of his power. I think that sometimes he's operating from his ego and he's playing with us. He's playing with the people that really connect to him and that are his fans. And I think that it almost feels like the person that has like the puppets that's kind of like playing with everyone, but he doesn't really understand how much it could affect everybody. I mean, I know people that were really like distraught over the things that he said, and I don't think he's well informed. So to say you're operating out of love, but to not, at least when you talk about being pro-Trump, but not to also say that he's not operated out of love when he's, you know, insinuated or created people to operate from a place of hate at a lot of times is really kind of crazy. Not when you're Kanye West.
Let's talk about the music. One thing we know, students of the game, all of the breakthroughs in new marketing, new exposure have come from the urban side, mm-hmm. Okay? So we've had SoundCloud, we've had mixtapes. Is this something that came up from the ground, or is this something you helped make happen? And what do you observe has happened?
No, it came from the ground. I mean, mixtapes have always existed. People operated from that place and when streaming came about, it really just created an opportunity for us to see what was already happening on a ground level. When SoundCloud and streaming came about, you got to see what was happening on a ground level already with my mixtapes, Dat Piff, et cetera. Urban music never went away. What happened was, how do you really monetize the music? Because kids were always listening to hip-hop and urban music. We just couldn't figure out how to make the money from it. So we had my mixtapes, we had Dat Piff, et cetera. SoundCloud came about. Then it was like, oh, you know, these artists are popping off. It's a great form of research. Then we worked out our deals at Spotify, Apple Music, et cetera, and we got to see how dominant the genre was or the culture was. And it changed everything. I mean, I lived it from being in a role at, you know, at Motown, where urban music, I mean, it was tough as shit for me. I went through a very hard time there to then see the complete shift happen, and it's a complete focus on urban music and culture now. It's because they get to see the full value because they see the money coming in now.
Well, I mean, it's just interesting because while the Heritage Acts and the White Acts kept complaining they weren't making any money from recorded music, the Urban Acts went in and filled the void and now own.
And they also... They knew how to roll up the sleeves and do the work, right? Like, they had to operate on a ground level. They had to do the mom and pop circuit. They had to get out there and get on the road, sell music, you know, from their trunks or whatever, or, you know, make their hoodies and T-shirts on their own and sell them while they were doing the shows. They did the groundwork. And to be honest with you, it really is a hip-hop lifestyle. I've had this conversation with R&B artists where I feel like they don't have the same work ethic as some of these hip-hop artists. Well, they'll go and do everything, whatever it takes. They call it the hustle, right? They do it all, and they just don't stop. And I think that you have to have that ability. And you got to have that work ethic in order to make it. It doesn't mean that you have to put out music the same way that they do. You just have to be able to work that hard and do whatever it takes. And that's where you get to see innovation and strategy and different ways to go about putting out records. People talk to me a lot about, you know, so I did this deal with Quality Control, right? And we put out a lot of records with them. And one of the things that we did in our deal with them is we included a distribution element to the deal through Caroline Distribution. And that was on purpose so that they could go bake things that they're used to baking without having the red tape that a major label kind of has. There's certain rules and regulations that we have so we can make money off of the things we put out. But if you have things just on a distribution level, you don't have those same rules and regulations that get in the way of you putting things out a certain way. But I put that in the deal because we have Caroline Distribution so that they still have freedom to do what they did, to do what they do when, for things they're developing.
Well, let's be very specific. If they're on Motown as opposed to Caroline, what would they be unable to do?
Put out certain videos on World Star Hip Hop, or put out videos on World Star Hip Hop, or put out mixtapes on Dat Piff or my mixtapes. And that's really just because of us not having worked out the deals with them yet to get paid properly. But if it's a distribution deal, we don't have to worry about that as much as they deal with that.
Let's say you're a star or a superstar, you know, the obvious one being Drake. He has now reinvented what a release is. Mm-hmm. He had the mixtape March 14 months ago. If you're a superstar, do you need an album? I mean, Kanye's been dropping these singles. Who knows whether they're a joke or real? But at the label, what are you telling the superstars to do?
I would want to hear an album from Drake because we're used to hearing albums from him. But he could put out several singles before releasing the full body of work. You know what I mean? It just depends on who the artist is. It's a different strategy for each act. It really is.
Well, let's go be very specific. Is the album dead?
No.
Well, if you look at the Spotify Top 50, which is consumption, mm-hmm. okay, we know that it's a lot of singles. And let's say The Weeknd comes out, he'll put out his album, and 4 of the top 10 will be Weeknd tracks, mm-hmm. okay? But then they'll fall off,
right?
Okay? And there'll be one track to the next track. We know that people, the customer demands a body of work. If you like something, you want to be able to hear more. What I always do if an act is new to me, I'll go on Spotify, see what has the most streams.
Right.
And I'll say, I'll play that next. So I definitely want stuff to be there. But if you go back you know, before the turn of the century, mm-hmm. the game was, okay, put out an album in the marketplace, I go single to single, you know, I go five. But the problem then, and the problem's been exacerbated now, in the window when you're not in the marketplace, other people will come and fill that hole and you might be forgotten.
Right.
So is it better just to be able to release product on a regular basis?
I believe it is. I think you can do it all. If you're a creator, so let's say Drake is making an album. He puts out several singles, leads into an album, and then he wants to go and drop other singles after that. He should be able to do that. I think streaming allows us an opportunity to put out music the way that we see fit without there being any fucking rules or regulations to how we go about it. I think that it's so different now, but when you mentioned Drake before, as a fan, you're used to getting full bodies of work from him, and people have bought into that idea and they believe in him in that way. So let's say, you know, it's our responsibility to create new superstars, right? People want to know what it is you stand for, what do you represent, et cetera. You have to have a body of work or several songs in order to really represent what that is. And it's going to take time to get there. You got to put out a lot of music to really convince people to buy in to who you are, what you stand for, et cetera, and to want to be in business with that artist, to want to, like, go to the fucking show, to want to watch your performance on the award show, to like buy your merch, et cetera. But it's our job to come up with ways to make sure we're telling your full story and getting people to buy into that artist.
But to what degree is the label behind in time of the artist? Because what do we know? The label makes their money off recorded music, and if they have an antiquated concept, the more tracks we put out, the more money we can make. Now, in today's, you know, a lot of these albums, you go on Spotify.
But I don't think, not to cut you off, but I don't think
you
that...
You can interrupt me all day.
We don't operate from a place of telling them you have to do it this way, though. You know what I mean? Like, that you have to put it out this way. I like to work with artists that are self-aware enough and know what they want to say or put out in the market, and we can help support that and come up with ways to do it. Or if they come and play you records, and then we talk about a strategy that makes sense for them. But the idea of dictating to an artist what they do and how they go about it doesn't really exist anymore. We can present ideas to them, but you want them to be self-aware enough to know what they want to do, what's a full expression. You
okay,
know what I mean?
So the artist is signed to you. They've had some success. They come with a record. You don't think the record is up to your standards. Will you say so?
Yes.
And will you refuse to put it out?
No, I'll let them bump their heads and fail and let them learn their lesson.
And speaking of failure, I was talking to Chris Zaru, manager of Logic, and he was saying how failure is not the disaster that it once was. That in the streaming era, if you fail, you can come back and be
Agreed.
Successful.
Agreed.
And why do you think that is?
Because it's really, I think overall it's about your resilience, right? And so if you keep putting music out, people will catch on eventually, you know? And I think that people have such a short attention span. If something was successful and you come right back with the next project and it is great, you actually have the opportunity to remind people that it's about the music, that it's about how great the music is. And that's what streaming has allowed us to really see, that it's about how great the music really is. So you really... The failure is really in if you give up, if you just decide that I can't take it. I can't take the opinions of, you know, anyone saying that my album was a fucking flop, et cetera. Then you just, like, go into depression somewhere and don't create great music. You got to keep going. And I think hip-hop as a culture has been operating from that place.
And let's say you sign a new act.
Mm-hmm.
What would you tell them to do to get themselves known?
Good question. Okay. Because I have a few new acts that we're working on. In addition to the music that they're making, right?
Well, I'm also talking about the distribution of said music.
They have to speak to their fans. In this, like, whatever the messaging is in their music, they have to speak to their fans, build their fan base, know what it is about them that will make people connect to them and build off of that. I also feel like it's really important to be on the road and develop a touring fan base in addition to putting out music or being on social media. I think oftentimes we've come across artists that might have an incredible social media following and then don't know how to connect to people in real life. And I think the live show element is a huge part of this. And I think that we need more artists that know how to do that. So I would definitely get them to focus on that. I think more now than ever, we have to make sure we're developing artists that can put together great shows. And knowing how to connect to their fans at the same time. And also, you know, we talk about the fashion element that kind of feeds into music as well, like building that out, if that's right for the artist. So it just depends. It's specific to each artist.
And how about in terms of raw distribution? You have a new act. Would you say to be on SoundCloud first? Would you say to put out a mixtape before you go?
It depends on who the artist is. It depends on who the artist is. And the funny thing about what a mixtape is now, so crazy what we call things, EP, mixtape, project. It all has these fucking labels. It's music at the end of the day. So we really just try to title it something that fits in the scheme of whatever the artist is ultimately trying to get to. Let's say we're building to an album, or there's an overall theme for several projects they're putting out. We'll come up with that as opposed to calling it a mixtape. We put out mixtapes that are really albums and made money on them, and they've been successful as if they're albums. You know what I mean? So it just depends on how you want to.
And also, in the hip-hop world, there's very much a culture online. Something comes out, people know.
Yeah.
And it immediately runs up the Spotify chart.
Mm-hmm.
Radio tends to be months behind. How important is terrestrial radio in the hip-hop world?
It's the end goal. That's it. It used to be the place for discovery, but for us now, it's like, it's just another, you know, another thing to mention on the hot sheet of all the things that you've achieved. But it's the end goal. You know, once you've put a record out, had a lot of success, et cetera, and then it goes to radio, it's just another, like, another marker.
Hope you're enjoying this episode of the Bob Lefsetz podcast. If you want to hear sound bites or check out videos and photos of our guests, go to @TuneIn on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Now, more of Ethiopia Habtemariam, recorded in front of a live audience at the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara on the Bob Lefsetz podcast.
Okay, questions for Ethiopia. Raise your hand. Jim has mics. Jake.
Thanks for coming here today. It was quite inspiring, I think. Two things. One comment I want to make to you, Bob, which you've never brought up, is Spotify doesn't actually have an album chart. And I think if they had an album chart, maybe we'd know what albums are doing well, because I just tried to look it up and it doesn't exist. So I think that's the biggest problem, is that you can't really talk about albums in reference to Spotify, because yeah, tracks come out and then they go down, because that's the process, is one single at a time. So maybe we should be pushing them to have an album chart, and then maybe it would make a difference. The other thing is, I'm wondering these days, as president of a major label or division of a major label, let's say, or major for what it is, how much are you looking at these bands like the Logics and these other acts that are kind of doing it on their own first and then coming in with a label? Or are you starting right from scratch with bands that have, you found talent, but they have no footprint whatsoever?
It's a balance of both, for sure. If there's something that has no following, or like, there's nothing going on with them at all, if they at least know exactly what they want to say, who they are as artists, I'm willing to invest in that if I think the music is incredible, because then I can help develop and cultivate that. And I've done that, right? But you definitely want to be a part of, you know, things that are moving or being created, and if you can help amplify it on a global level. I think what Logic has done has been incredible. But I'm definitely still about development and finding things that are great and okay, unique and different.
And how often do you, as a label, experience the Chance the Rapper paradigm where you want an act and the act says, no, I want to do it myself?
I mean, it's come up a lot. It's come up a lot recently. I have to be completely honest about that. And so the idea is, you know, what can we offer them, and how do we really show what the difference will be if we're involved in their careers or not, right? And I think that it comes down to the people at the companies. It comes down to really showing them the difference in money that they'll be making. I also think it's important to show on a global level what you add to an artist in their overall career. It's been a real education process. It's come up a lot where artists have no idea about the global aspect. We talk about urban music or hip-hop culture being huge. It's huge around the world, but a lot of the acts don't travel around the world. They don't go really penetrate the markets the way that they should. And so that's been something that I've been working on because I want to show people the difference in not only, you know, show money you can make in the market, but how you can really increase your sales, how you can go get big branding deals, how you can really amplify your overall career if you travel. And there are a lot of artists who don't see it because they're either just caught up in the perception of what they see on social media and the little bit of money that they're making on the road, and they feel like they're popular. That's not real fucking success. Like, I think for a lot of these younger kids, they feel like the popularity is what they see on social media. They're hot for the minute. They can go to these parties, and they can make a little bit of money on the road, and they're in the cool crowd. But you're not really making real money. You haven't achieved real success yet, and I think it's important to educate them. We went through an exercise where we were like, let's put real numbers in front of them.
But is it affecting royalty rates as you're trying to woo these acts? Is the label giving up a higher percentage?
No, it's just educating them on the more money they can be making and how their sales can be. I mean, I went through it. We just went through this with Migos, honestly. You know, we've had a very successful album with them with Culture 2. I mean, you know, I'll be honest about it. Getting them to go to Europe for their European promo run was a real fight. But it was an education process for them because they had been with 300 where they didn't know anything about it. Their last record wasn't fully supported. They didn't know. They would just go collect checks to do shows over there, but they didn't know about really going to the market, really supporting the record, really doing the shows, and how to really connect to the fans there and what that would lead to. They love fashion. Let's go spend a real week in Paris. Let's put a dinner together where we're sitting with these designers, and it's planting seeds that really connect to a bigger thing, you know, like things that can help grow their careers. And that's the added value that we can bring to them, because then they'll have a longer career. It adds some more sales for us, you know.
Okay, over here.
Would love to hear a story, a time when you were in a room with a hot contemporary artist, and they met an iconic artist, maybe someone from the earlier days, somebody from the city, where you were in that room and you got to see the interaction. And I'd love to know what your takeaway was and what the takeaway was for each of the artists.
Well, okay, I've been in the room where we introduced people to Berry Gordy. And the reverence that people have for Mr. Gordy is really, you know, it's incredible because people don't know what he's like. You know, they have no idea. And he's pretty charismatic. His memory is incredible. So, and I this wouldn't be an artist, but I'm thinking about the guys from QC, and we introduced them to Mr. Gordy in the office and what that meant for them. So Quality Control is the label out of Atlanta that has Migos and Yachty in. As I was trying to redevelop Motown, one of my goals was to use Motown as a platform for other black entrepreneurs that were developing their own companies. And so QC was one of them, and I did my deal with them 3.5 years ago. And Mr. Gordy was at the office one day. Steve Barnett and I were meeting with him, and the guys from QC were there. This is before things popped off for them. And we had them meet. And the level of inspiration, you know, they just look like little kids, you know, meeting there, you know, the person they looked up to the most. So the funny thing is, as they're talking, I knew this, but we had never talked about it before. Mr. Gordy tells them that he called his A&R meetings the Quality Control meetings. And, like, it was the big aha moment for them. They're like, oh, this is meant to be. Like, this is, everything is aligned. And even though we weren't having success yet, I think we all knew, like, it's going to come. It's going to happen. And that was a pretty cool moment that happened a few years ago.
Okay, get a mic.
Ryder's next, but I have a mic, so I'm going to ask. I was going to ask the question that you just kind of brought up, which was, you know, when you go and visit
Disney. Louder, Jim.
When you go and visit Disney. No one's ever said louder, Jim, before, right? When you go and visit Disney, you know, there's they try to instill Walt Disney into you, right? Mm-hmm. When you're at on the new Apple campus, like there's, you know, quotes from Steve Jobs on the walls. Like, is Barry Gordy important to, or Mr. Gordy, I guess, is it important to your culture that you're building to, you know, remember what was?
Absolutely. Cool. Definitely. One of the things that we've done, so when I first met him, go to Mr. Gordy's house, he has a ton of footage from all, you know, from all his A&R meetings, from back when they would have picnics, et cetera, with the Motown family. He had he recorded everything, but wasn't doing anything with it. And so I told Steve about it. Long story short, you know, we convinced Mr. Gordy to allow us to do a Motown documentary using all of this footage that he has, which is something that I think a lot of people tried to do, but we've been able to achieve it. So it's something that'll come out next year. And the motivation behind it was to, one, remind people the foundation of how Motown was created, but also the foundation of, like, music, right? Like, it's about great songs. It's about work ethic. It's about people coming together. And for him, it was also about love, you know? And also we connected the dots between a lot of other people that have been influenced by Motown over time, so.
Okay, Mark?
First of all, this has been a great conversation. I just want you to know that I've got two daughters, and I think it would be amazing if they could go into the business and just follow in your footsteps. And if I had sons, I'd say the same thing. But
I appreciate that.
It's been very inspirational. My question, though, is, do you find it, in today's marketplace, do you find it more challenging to develop a brand-new artist or to help with the comeback of an already established artist who's coming back from a very disappointing album, both commercially, or whether it's commercially or critically or both?
It's tough with, you know, trying to have the comeback for an artist that's been established and has been around for, like, let's say 10 years. It's tough. It's tough if they haven't taken the time to really educate themselves on the new way of operating. I know artists that were huge 10 years ago that really haven't caught on to the way streaming is working, like, that don't really have Spotify or Apple Music on their phones. I'm like, what are you doing? How do you even know? But they're artists who don't really, you know what I mean? And they were huge 10 years ago. So it's really tough. And they can't really adjust to the new marketplace. They can't really adjust to the way things are operating now. And, you know, you can lead them down the road, but if they're not willing to change the way that they operate, it ultimately comes down to change. How willing are you to change? Some people get stuck in their ways.
Can Stevie Wonder have another hit?
Yes.
And how will you make that happen?
I don't know, Bob. But I'll take the challenge.
Well, is it about inspiring him? You have a long career in creative.
Stevie has... he's been writing music. He's had music for, I mean, we've tried for years to try and get new music out of Stevie. I pray it happens. We will all do everything we can to...
And in a hip-hop world, and we've seen in the last year, all the pop acts have failed in the marketplace. Miley Cyrus, Katy Perry, Taylor Swift. If someone is in the urban field and it's more of a ballad or an R&B thing than hip-hop, can it work?
Yes. But it's not even about it being just about hip-hop. I think it ultimately comes down to how great the song is. You know what I mean? When we talk about Katie or Miley, et cetera, they can all come back with great, great songs. And we need music. We need them to come back, and we need them to come back with substantial music that can connect. I think we also need, you know, outside of these new hip-hop artists or hip-hop artists in general, to talk about the times and things that are happening. Without sounding preachy, we need our pop artists to create great music that can connect to all people as well. I grew up loving pop music also. You know what I mean? And so you want to see that happen.
Okay. Over here, there was someone with a mic. Okay. Heather.
Hi. Ethiopia, first, I'm seconding what Mark said. Just total respect on every level for you.
And
thank you also for deftly handling Bob's challenging questions about race and gender. So just round of applause for that.
Thank you. I hope I answered them.
Okay. So
if you don't push the edges, you'll never know where they are.
Right. Question about representing and promoting female artists. And I know you've worked with Erykah Badu, but I also notice your roster has more men, and wondered if you could address that. Do you see a day when it'll be more balanced? Are there particular challenges in promoting women? Why is it that there are less women at the top, women artists?
That's all I want, is more female artists. And in my career before as a publisher, I worked with more female talent. Thank you for noting that my roster is more men, because it's something, when people ask me what I'm looking for, I'm like, I want a female artist. I want, I don't know why it's so hard to find great new female talent. I don't know what the problem is. I've been looking. I'm being completely honest with you. I've been looking. I've been trying to find great female acts to sign. For me, I want them to be artists that write their own music as well. And are pretty self-aware. I think that I've come across a lot of talent that might have the right aesthetic, but not have, you know, the substance or the feel, or they don't really know who they are. I'm not really trying to subscribe to any of that. I don't think that really cuts through. And I've seen a lot of female artists get distracted or confused by perception or celebrity, et cetera, and you have to really be a beast at it. You see the best of the best in the marketplace, the superstars, they really are incredibly intelligent, have an incredible work ethic, and work their asses off, right? And know when to listen, know who on their team are the people to listen to, who when they need better people on their team, and I just think it's hard to find that now.
Okay, so next question here.
But if anyone has anyone they want to bring to me, please let me know, because I am actively looking for new female acts.
Mr. Boyle.
Hi, I just want to echo what the other folks said. And when you find the right man, he will be a very lucky man. So,
thank you. I believe that.
No, in all seriousness, you know, you talked about, one thing, Stevie, so I run Live Nation Japan. We're talking to CAA. Stevie Wonder is still worth 50,000 to 60,000 tickets in that market. And we're probably, I hope, we're going to do two Saitama arenas with them in 2019. And wow. That's like a dream come true for me to get to work with Stevie.
So you can't have a hit again.
I'm sorry?
You can't have a hit again.
And you should come.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Yeah. You mentioned the trouble with getting Migos to Europe, right? What's happening in Asia right now is there's been this EDM revolution, which is still kind of happening. Japan is the most mature of the Eastern markets. Mm-hmm. And hip-hop is all the rage there. However, these acts can't really sell many hard tickets yet. The biggest acts, I'm not going to name, are worth about 3,000 tickets. Live Nation and Insomniac, I came from Insomniac, took an investment in the Rolling Loud Festival, which clearly you know all about.
I will be there in Miami.
Yes, the premier hip-hop festival in the world, mm-hmm. right? There's 50, 60,000 people. Every hot hip-hop artist plays it. We're trying to bring it to Asia. We had dates on hold. We're going to do it in multiple countries. The artists weren't reasonable with their fees.
They were not.
They were not. And I think that's going to be a challenge. So I guess my question to you is how do you see the Asian market for hip-hop? I'm kind of like the Asian flag waver at this conference, because it is the panacea for all of this.
No, there's huge opportunity there.
Yeah.
And it's disturbing to hear that everyone's coming back asking for a ton of money. Because, again, I know the mentality is to just hit a lick, to just get a big check, as opposed to thinking about really penetrating the market and the opportunity that exists there. And so, it's the education process. And I think that, you know, sometimes your job is to be a translator, and it's about having the right people on the team that can really translate for them why it makes sense. you know, a lot of times at my company, when it comes to some of the hip hop, the bigger hip hop acts that we have, I end up having to do everything because I can be a translator in some ways to get them to do things. But if there's, if anything is pertaining to Migos and them coming to the market, let me know. Okay. But I'll tell you, I've heard about certain huge acts that have never come to Japan. Huge. Some of our biggest superstars here have not gone there, and I just think it's a lack of understanding. Yeah. But I think that there'd be an opportunity to get a few of the big managers together and to really walk them through it and educate them, and I think that would be the right next step.
Okay. Anybody else with a mic there?
Yes. Yeah, I got a quick question for you. There's no doubt the urban and hip-hop rap side have had such a direct pulse to the consumer, mm-hmm. more so than any other format, right? It's mind-boggling. I watch it with my own kids. Do you ever sit around and go, wow, I can't believe these other formats have not figured this out? Like when you said what you guys have been able to figure out and go, it's amazing they haven't figured that out, you know, from a strategic standpoint, right?
You mean like other genres of music?
Yeah, yeah. When you sit in other shows, like, I can't believe they're, you know, when you're sitting in your strategy meetings with other form, you know, and they go, I can't believe they have not figured this out, right? And I'm not trying to give, you know, the secret recipe to the best chocolate chip cookie, right? But I'm, you know, what, you know, you sit like, I can't believe rock or whatever it is, they have not figured out this one thing to connect.
Here's the thing. I believe that it's always just a matter of time. I'm not one of those people that's like, oh, this genre of music is dead or whatever. I think that that's all bullshit. I think that it's only a matter of time before music is music. It reinvents itself, right? So I think that you just don't give up on it and you figure out what is connecting. I even think that when you think about campaigns for artists, like what is it that will connect the dots? And I think that as you think about other genres, you kind of have to dig deeper to figure out how to really make.
Speaking of that, is this country urban crossover, is this a blip on the radar screen or a new trend?
It's a new trend, and I think it's real because we're looking at kids that might have come up listening to country music and also like other, like the fusion of the different genres, that's a real thing.
Well, it's very interesting because, as I say, I think people are grazers. They know more things. And it's interesting what is seen as the most right-wing of formats, their audience has urban fans, too.
100%. You see what's happened with Kane Brown, which has been amazing, right? But he's with mixed kids singing country music, and it's real. It's authentic to him. I think the other thing is, like, the bullshit meter is real, right? You can't fool kids. I've never been one of those people that believe, like, you dictate what's next and you tell people what's next. They connect to what's real and authentic, and I think that we're seeing a lot more of that pop up where people are inspired by a lot of different kinds of music. They can infuse them, and they create great music from that. And then it ends up cutting through, and then we think it's, like, the biggest thing in the world. It's like, no, someone just did what was real for them.
Now, it's also interesting you said earlier that you're looking for female artists who are writers. Does this portend the end of the record with 15 writers?
I wouldn't say that. I just know specifically for me, when I've worked with artists who know who they are and know what they want to say, I feel like it goes further. So that's what I'm looking for.
But as a publisher, do you think it's good, bad, or irrelevant that there's so many writers on these records?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, because your shares are getting cut down. When you have that many writers on one song, you're getting nothing, really. You know what I mean? Like, you might have two or three, four, cool. But when you have that many writers on, you're not really making shit. You know what I mean? You're really not. You're really not. I mean, you know, for hip-hop records, too, I'll say this. There are a lot of people on these songs, because you're seeing a lot of producers work together. Work together on tracks, but they end up with, you know, not a lot of percentage on their records. And again, that's an education process. People don't really understand what it means.
And at this point in time, to what is it, a hackneyed thing, or is it still valid to have a guest appearance to boost a career?
You don't have to have it. You don't have to have it.
But does it still work if you want to do that way?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, anybody else in the back there? Marty?
Good afternoon, and I do bleed orange, being a Clemson guy, but for those of you who have never been to Athens, Georgia, you have to go.
Yeah.
It's an amazing experience, great, rich music history, and Atlanta and Athens are something to behold. So for you, anybody who's down in the Southeast, I highly recommend.
Yeah.
Go check it out. I think I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but I think you said something earlier about today failure means giving up. So in the spirit of technology and connectability and the fact that we're all connected, when you are evaluating an artist, do you consider an artist's resiliency with respect to their evaluation of talent? Is that something that you feel like you have to throw into the blender when you're
100%,
looking to invest?
100%. That's a huge part of it. Huge part of how resilient you are. I mean, I've learned that in my own life and in my own career, but I've seen many examples of if you are resilient, if you can just push through, it will make all the difference. Eventually it connects. And, you know, at this point, I've been in the business about 20 years now, right? And I've seen people that just never gave up. People that some people doubted and never thought would ever make it or ever have a hit.
Oh, but there are some people who should give up, right?
And, you know, I think people who should give up are the people that are only motivated by the fucking fame. That's the truth. If you're not really motivated by your love and passion for the music, you can tell the difference. You know what I mean? And also, if you're only motivated by the money, if you're only motivated by the money and you don't operate with any level of ethics in this business, I want you out this shit too. You know what I mean? Like, because you're really kind of disrespecting our world, because you have to have a respect for the music. I think that we've suffered from a lot of people that don't have a respect for music and the gift of music, and I have a huge regard for it, so I want to see more people in it that do as well, and I think that everything is coming full circle. But yes, resiliency is a big part of this.
Ethiopia, you've been utterly fab. Oh, wait.
Two quick questions.
Okay. Sorry. I don't want to wear her out. Okay, I'll let you be the wrangler here, Jim.
All right. Okay. Great talk. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm a bloody foreigner. I arrived in this country 3 years ago. And I wasn't aware, and I didn't even understand structural racism. Coming here was mind-blowing to see how that works. I mean, you're talking to a room that is almost exclusively white, right? Now, then I went into the Black Panther movie. On the day it came out, because I was so stoked by the soundtrack, right. I got into that theater, and I was almost exclusively the only white person in that movie, which was a revelation. That movie was amazing and a celebration in itself. Now, how do you see, now it crossed like $1.2 billion on the box office. How do you foresee ripple effects of that movie? What did it do?
It created opportunities for other movies to be created around Black culture, et cetera. But also, I think it brought together a lot of people. So for me, I could talk about Black Panther all day, because I told my parents, I was like, Wakanda was supposed to be Ethiopia. They fucked it up. Anyway, but I think that what they created with that piece of art is what I thought would happen with music. I thought that there would be an artist that would create a great song or a great body of work that would connect people in the same way. And I think that Black Panther, the film, really brought together all people. You know what I mean? All kinds of people, all ethnicities, and allowed people to connect and respect, you know, our culture. And it was based in love. Kanye wants to talk about love, that film felt like it was based in love and the idea of bringing people together in that way. I thought there would be a musical artist or someone that would create art that would connect people, but it ended up being that film that did it. And I think it's the beginning of seeing other art forms that can bring all people together without making people feel alienated. Because you may have been in a theater with all Black people, but I was in Westwood at IPIC, and I was like the only Black person in there with a bunch of white people, and I was happy about it because I got to see other cultures watching the film too and appreciating it. So.
And one more question, Jim.
Hey, I was interested in the the correlation, as you see it, with, you know, ticket sales and visiting markets, and you said about not being big because you have a following, but we all know what global success means. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back in the 90s, it was, of course, a different world. But to actually make, I'm from Sweden, so mm-hmm. to get the great artists of, I was working at LaFace Records and Loud and all these mm-hmm. records, bringing these artists in, and to have a presence, I think it's still as important. But it's so hard to connect with the audience and get the ticket sales now, as the gentleman from Live Nation told us, because there is no presence, and there's just songs. So what as a, you know, you're Motown, but it's, do you know what does Universal do to promote these acts in foreign countries? And how do they support bringing them over these days? I have no clue, and it's like, I think it's really connected.
Yeah, I mean, I think I touched on it a little bit before, because the global marketing and supporting our acts around the world is like a huge priority for us. And I can tell you, we come up with campaigns and plans that are about each territory. And, you know, we have marketing people that really talk about what's happening in each territory, and I hold them responsible for making sure they know how to impact that artist in each territory. And it's not the same campaign for each artist. You know, I expect them to know what will penetrate, which artist is the right person to collaborate with the local artists there. Like, they have to know the touch and feel of each act. But the global aspect of it all is very important to us, and we work with each territory to come up with the plans for our acts. I'll tell you, at the top of this year, we do this like 2 or 3 times a year, where we go around the world. I went to Sweden, went to France, I went to London with Steve and our head of international, and we presented all our top priorities for the year, and we talked about the plans for each of those acts. And, you know, in each office, we went to Spotify offices, et cetera, and we talked about what our rollout, and they came to us with ideas. And, I mean, it's a huge priority for us. Huge.
Ethiopia, you're incredibly charismatic. As I say, I think you're going to have to check men on a regular basis, because they're drawn to you. But this has really been fabulous, eye-opening. I'm sure everyone is agreeing with me that we've learned so much here today. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
That wraps up this week's episode of the Bob Lefsetz podcast with executive extraordinaire Ethiopia Habtemariam, president of Motown Records, recorded live in Santa Barbara only a month ago. She's a force of nature. Look out for her in the future. Till next time, I'm Bob Lefsetz. Don't know exactly why.